History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life?
From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations with Jeff Stein and Gene Meserve.
Hi, I'm Jeff Stein.
And I'm Gene Meserve.
We're devoting the entire Spy Talk podcast this week to my interview with Leon Panetta. He's had an extraordinarily broad and deep career in Washington, first as a congressman, later as a budget director in the White House, chief of staff to President Clinton, and of course, CIA director and Secretary of Defense.
And you guys cover the globe in this conversation, from Afghanistan to Iran, China, Russia, cyber, election interference. You talked about it all.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff in that 55 minutes. Of course, the pinnacle of his career was the elimination of Osama bin Laden in May 2011. But there were failures on his watch too, as he admits, in Afghanistan and in diagnosing correctly the Arab Spring. In any event, I started with a question that put him back on his heels a little bit. Welcome, Secretary Panetta. It's such a great pleasure to have you aboard here for our fifth Spy Talk podcast. Let's get right to it. The current CIA director, Bill Burns, has written that his greatest professional and moral regret was not doing more to stop President Bush from invading Iraq in 2003 when he was a senior State Department official. What's your greatest regret? Do you regret supporting, for example, President Obama's decision to send 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan in 2009? That hasn't turned out too well.
Well, you generally go through a number of challenges in each administration I've been a part of, whether it's the Clinton administration or whether it's the Obama administration. Generally, you know, I really believe that whether it was President Clinton or President Obama, that both of them in the end tried to make decisions that they felt were in the interest of the country. And whether you agree or disagree with them, in the end, I really think that they did what they thought was the right thing to do. You know, having said that, obviously, we made a couple of mistakes that I have always stuck in my mind. One is, frankly, with the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring happened. There were a lot of demonstrations. A lot of young people were taking to the streets, and it was a tremendous opportunity to really try to do some good in that part of the world. And there really was, there were two things that that didn't happen. We really didn't have that much of a heads up in the intelligence community about the various factors that contributed to the Arab Spring, to really understand what was going on and what ultimately took place.
Are you saying that the intelligence community, which we spend untold billions on, didn't know what was going on in Egypt, in Tunisia, Libya, elsewhere?
Obviously, our people on the ground were aware of what was happening, but to kind of step back and look at the Middle East as a whole, and the fact that these factors were impacting in each of these countries and creating the same dynamics that resulted in people going to the streets and wanting change in their government. And I just don't think we had a good handle on all of the factors that were at play here, whether it was social media, whether it was the economic conditions that were impacting on young people, whether it was their sense of frustration with whatever government they were dealing with, to see all of that suddenly come together, not just in Libya, not just in Yemen, not just in Egypt, not just in Syria, but all throughout the Middle East, was a very important event that took place. And I think we were not prepared, frankly, to deal with how we would respond to what was happening. And that that's something that I think we could have done a better job at.
So that answer was prompted by my question of what was your greatest regret as CIA director, and I should throw in as Secretary of Defense. Are you saying we did the wrong things when the Arab Spring erupted?
No, it's not that we did the wrong things. It's just that we didn't really try to develop approaches that would try to create some sense of stability in these countries. And I think it's largely because, you know, we really didn't put together the kind of alliances that we needed with countries in that region, whether it was the moderate Arab countries, UAE, others, working with the Saudis as well as Jordan, having a sense of what is the cultural background of these countries, what's the tribal background of these countries, understanding what would be the right approach to trying to direct them in a way that would result in governments that would be more stable and would provide opportunity to the very people that were concerned about their countries. I think we just did not have the right response to how we would try to assist these countries and leaders in those countries to do the right thing on behalf of their people.
You know, I think that would be pretty unsettling to a lot of people, especially taxpayers who put billions of dollars into our intelligence systems, putting aside the cynics in Washington who say that the CIA could never get anything right. So not to get too far down into the weeds on this, but would you say that we switched horses too quickly in Egypt, for example?
Yeah, I think we were trying to determine what was the best course for some degree of stability in Egypt. And the Muslim Brotherhood just did not turn out to be a very effective option in dealing with the situation in Egypt. With regards to Libya, you know, after we had defeated Gaddafi and had seen at least the semblance of an effort to try to organize some kind of governance in Libya, it suddenly resorted to its tribal instincts and really never came together. So part of the problem is that we really just did not understand enough about each of these countries and the dynamics in each of these countries to try to develop a stable approach. That's probably the bottom line.
All right. And we can hope that situation has been rectified, that we have people in the intelligence community who have a better grip on world affairs, and especially that region, than they did in your time. So let's flip the card and say, let me ask you, what is your greatest pride as CIA director in particular, getting Osama bin Laden, I would guess, would be at the top or near the top?
Well, yeah, there's no question that I think the whole effort to go after the leadership of al-Qaeda and those that were involved in the attack on 9/11, to be able to, on behalf of our country, make sure that a 9/11 attack would not happen again. And obviously, the centerpiece of that strategy was the mission to go after bin Laden, develop the intelligence, develop the operation, and then successfully carry out that mission. There's no question that was a moment that I'll always be proud of, mainly because it was a team effort. And also, I think, sent a message to the world that nobody attacks the United States of America and gets away with it.
So the message was repercussions. But to you, the teamwork involved, and we have had in the past disastrous efforts at teamwork, for example, trying to rescue the American hostages at the embassy in Tehran. And so this was really the acme of that effort to create multi-force, multi-agency teamwork in the area of counterterrorism.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right, Jeff. That, you know, what had developed prior to that operation was that coming out of 9/11, there was a sense that if we were going to be effective at dealing with this this enemy called Al-Qaeda, that we were going to have to develop a relationship between our intelligence capabilities and our special forces military capabilities. They found that that kind of effort was absolutely essential in going after the terrorist targets. And ultimately, it really became the centerpiece of our counterterrorism effort was to have intelligence and special forces working very closely together in order to identify targets and then carry out those operations. And that teamwork is what came together in going after bin Laden. The intelligence capabilities of following the couriers to bin Laden, identifying them, following them to the compound where bin Laden was, the intelligence analysis that went on when we determined that there was a family that matched the bin Laden family living on the third floor of that compound, the ability to kind of look at every aspect of the intelligence so that we knew generally what was happening with regards to that compound and the security measures that were being taken, and then to have special forces come in and actually then put together the operation itself to send two teams of SEALs into Pakistan to rappel down into that compound and go after bin Laden. That combination was one of the most effective military intelligence capabilities that I think I've seen in a very long time.
There's a new book coming out by former intelligence officials that is again going to defend the use of enhanced interrogation techniques, which is widely known as torture. You came down very firmly on the side that we don't need to engage in those kind of practices anymore. Is that correct?
That's correct. When I became a CIA director, on the day before I went to the office, President Obama issued an executive order that got rid of the enhanced interrogation techniques. I think that while I understand the context that people were operating in at the time and the fear that that Al-Qaeda might very well have other attacks planned against the United States. Nevertheless, I agree with those in the FBI and in the military who felt that we could gather that kind of intelligence without having to resort to torture.
Mm-hmm. I was just watching a documentary the other night about Ritchie's Boys, the operatives, World War II operatives, mostly Jews, who were trained in special operations and spying and sent into France. And it's really interesting, near the end, they say they were also used to interrogate German prisoners. And they said the best technique was not force, not torture, but just conversations and eliciting information. But yeah, moving on from that.
I watched the same program, and I had the same reaction, that they thought the best approach was to get friendly with who they were talking to, share their concerns, develop a relationship, and they got the information they needed.
Right, and you probably know that a former Luftwaffe interrogator testified to much the same after the war, that he got a lot more out of captured Allied pilots and so on by just establishing a relationship with them. But moving along, you've also written in your wonderful memoir, I really enjoyed it, by the way, that it's the CIA's director's duty to tell uncomfortable truths, as you put it, to the president. What's the most difficult, uncomfortable truth that you told President Obama?
Well, I have to think about that one, but, you know, I think it's important if you're in intelligence. And I remember telling the president this when he nominated me. I said, you know, in the end, my commitment is to telling the truth to power. I think that's the role of intelligence. That's
and he said he wouldn't want it any other way.
That's right. No, exactly. He said, I want you to do that. And to his credit, he did want us to present the facts as we saw them, and that's exactly what we did. And you know, I can remember difficult presentations, particularly with regards to Afghanistan and what we saw happening there, that indicated that, you know, all of the positive pictures that were being painted about what was taking place in Afghanistan did not really reflect what was happening on the ground.
Well,
make those presentations.
Indeed, my former Washington Post colleague, Craig Whitlock, has written in depth about this, that the generals were lying to themselves, lying to their superiors, and lying to the public for years and years and years about progress in Afghanistan. I know that you were aware of that.
Yeah.
So how do you combat that? How do you combat that?
Security Council, that's basically the exchanges that took place.
Yeah. And it must have been some very trying moments.
Yes. It's, you know, I think it's important that that when you're presenting that kind of intelligence, that you can't reflect, and you shouldn't reflect, what the policy decision ought to be with regards to the president. As a matter of fact, by law, intelligence personnel are supposed to make the presentation, but not engage in the discussion about what approach the president should take. And that's probably not a bad idea, because, you know, as long as you can present the facts and then ultimately basically allow the principals then to discuss what approach should be done based on those facts, that really is the role of a CIA director and, for that matter, the director of national intelligence.
But it is still pretty astounding that it took a really talented investigative reporter to get that story out after, what, 16, 17, 18 years? The public was not really aware that the generals themselves thought the war was a loser.
Yeah, no, I think what happens is, you know, you've got a lot of forces on the ground. You've got people that are losing their lives. They're putting their lives on the line. You know, there is a sense that you have to show that sacrifice is not being lost, that we are, in fact, trying to accomplish the mission. So I don't, you know, the generals that I work with, I don't assign devious methods to what they were saying. I think they were really trying to reflect the hope that the mission would in effect, you know.
They hoped it would turn out better year after year.
That's right. Exactly.
Hi, I'm Jean Meserve. You're listening to my co-host Jeff Stein interview former CIA Director and Defense Secretary Leon Panetta. We hope you'll subscribe to the full Spy Talk podcast series wherever you get your podcasts. And for more unique, in-depth material on U.S. and foreign intelligence operations, visit the Spy Talk page on Substack. Now, back to the interview.
Of course, in your term of Secretary of Defense, you dealt a lot with Russia and China, the threats and challenges from them. What worries you the most about our situation in the world today? Is it China's encroachments in the Western Pacific, Russian threats in Europe, North Korea's nukes, Iran's uranium enrichment? Pick one or put them in order. But during your time, what was the most unnerving threat, you might say?
You know, you just in the way you presented that question, it's a reflection of the number of flashpoints we're dealing with in the world.
The kitchen's on fire.
21st century. It's no matter where you look, you're dealing with another threat. And you've mentioned them all. China probably at the top right now, only because I think they themselves have made clear that they're going to try to take over as the world's major power. Russia, obviously, with Putin being much more aggressive. We're in a second stage of the Cold War with Russia. North Korea and their nuclear development. Iran and their threats to develop a nuclear weapon. What's happening with these failed states in the Middle East represents another challenge to the United States. And terrorism remains a threat as well from ISIS, as well as other versions of Al-Qaeda that you, are still
speaking
out
about, but speaking let, about
let,
terror.
Let me sure. answer your sure, basic sure. question.
Okay. Your,
what worried me then, and frankly what's worried me now, is an area that I think we have not really developed the kind of response we need to, which is cyber. I think cyber is the battlefield of the present and the battlefield of the future. And as we've seen from the cyber attacks that have impacted on the United States, whether it's on election institutions from Russia, or whether it's solar winds, or whether it's this recent effort to shut down a major pipeline to the East Coast, I think what it tells us is that we are, for whatever reason, we have not developed the kind of defenses, and probably for that matter, the kind of offenses we need in order to be able to respond to those attacks.
I'd like to ask you about that. Just recently, I was talking with Jack Devine. You probably know him, the former senior operations official at the CIA for more than 30 years.
Yeah.
And he was saying that it's really time, past time, that we warn Russia in no uncertain terms that it's going to pay a heavy price for continuing to interfere in our political life, particularly our elections, and that we will repay them in kind if they don't stop. He was suggesting sort of a mafia-style sit-down with them, you know, out of public view, say, look, got to stop, or we're going to turn out your lights. We're going to shut off your oil. We're going to start taking out your people. What do you think of that?
Well, I have a feeling we passed that line a long time ago. And, you know, we've been issuing all kinds of warnings to the Russians about what they've done with these cyber attacks against the United States. And, you know, obviously I'm not read in on the intelligence in the last few years, but I have seen no evidence that we have responded in kind. And I think that it is important when you are attacked the way we have been by the Russians again and again to send a signal to them that makes clear that we can do the same thing to them. I think that is an important signal that should have been sent a long time ago.
It's been said that in the past, we have actually done that. We've done sort of a little wave through the screen. Hello, we're here. We've turned their lights off and on just to give them an idea that we're here and we can do the same. But as far as you know, it hasn't gone beyond that.
No, and I think, you know, I'm not aware of just exactly what kind of offensive methods we've used, but I think that these countries are not going to pay attention unless you make clear that you can make their life uncomfortable as a result of what they're doing. They have largely undermined stability in our country by virtue of what they're doing. I have said, and I said it when I was Secretary of Defense, that my greatest fear is that we could suffer a cyber Pearl Harbor in the future that would literally cripple our country. I think what we saw happen in these last few days, where a major pipeline can be interrupted, tells us that if you use a sophisticated virus, you can probably take down our transportation systems, our chemical systems, our water systems, our power systems, our financial systems, our legislative systems. You can shut this country down. What we have to do is not only develop better defenses to deal with that, because my greatest worry right now is that between the Chinese and the Russians, that they have placed viruses already within our infrastructure that could ultimately be activated in the future. I hope that we are doing to them some of the same things.
There's been some reporting that we have been doing some of those things to them, at least tickling their wire, so to speak. Some experts worry that Russia and China will team up to attack the West. What are your thoughts on that? And did you consider that during your terms as CIA director and Secretary of Defense?
Well, there was no question that we saw China and Russia and Iran and North Korea developing their cyber capabilities putting a larger investment in that area. And for that matter, using cyber in their various military plans. And that something that the United States, frankly, was doing as well. The threat of China and Russia coming together and operating as a team was not present at that time. But I think as a result of these last number of years and the fact that both Russia and China read weakness on the part of the United States in terms of our response, I think it created a greater incentive for them to try and work together. Whether they can is still a question, but it nevertheless represents a potential threat for the future.
Did you ever discover signs of serious Russian meddling in our elections in 2008 or 12?
Not to the extent, obviously, that we saw happen in 2016. Look, I think it isn't a secret that both the United States and Russia have been trying to influence elections in various parts of the world for a long time. But obviously, cyber introduces a whole new weapon to that task. And so did we see evidence of them trying to influence elections? Yes, particularly in other countries, more so than in the United States. Right. But I think the reality is that they now see, as a result of what they did in 2016, a very successful effort to create chaos in this country.
Right.
They're not going to forget that lesson.
They've been trying to influence American politics since not long after the Soviet Revolution in 1917, 1918, but they never really found fertile ground here. But just to nail this down, you did detect some efforts by Moscow in the 2008 and 2012 elections. They just weren't getting any traction. Is that what you're saying?
I think to put it accurately, it was not out of line from what they had tried to do in the past in terms of, trying to influence some of the approaches to elections or those involved in elections. But it was a pretty amateur approach to trying to impact on our elections. They've obviously learned a great deal about America and our use of social media, and have really kind of used that as a centerpiece to develop a very bold effort to try to undermine our election systems.
Can you say anything more about those amateur efforts?
Not really.
Sending agents here, manipulating social media.
No, it's basically the effort to, use some media to try to get messages across, try to use some influence on some of the players that are involved in elections, try to see if you can gain a foothold with some of those individuals that are working in elections. It was really an approach that was not in any way as direct as what we've seen recently.
I can imagine them really getting behind the candidacy of Sarah Palin, for example. What a way to stir chaos in our system. Well, let's turn to another sunny subject, North Korea. It's been widely reported that President Obama told incoming President Trump that his biggest problem was going to be North Korea and pay attention to it. He did, in his own way. One scenario of a conflict with North Korea has them taking out Seoul very quickly and stopping and waiting to see if we would trade, say, Los Angeles for Pyongyang with an exchange of nuclear missiles. Did you contemplate that during your time in office at CIA or the Pentagon?
Well, I mean, obviously there are all kinds of conversations that go on about possibilities. But frankly, the main focus of our concern at the time was their ability to not only develop nuclear weapons, but develop the kind of weapon that could be placed at the top of a missile and the kind of missile that would be able to attack our homeland. That was really the primary focus of our concern.
And now they have them. It seems that they have missiles that can accurately, to one degree or another, strike at least the West Coast and maybe beyond that. If they were to take out Seoul, what do you think the United States' action would be? Start a attack them?
I think we would... We would be forced to respond in kind, and I think that that is pretty much the approach that if they indeed tried to take out Seoul, that the next step would be to take out Pyongyang.
And then the next question is, well, what happens the next day?
I think you've raised the issue of escalation and where it stops, and I don't know that anybody really knows the answer to that.
All right. Another fun question. Iran and Israel. You write in quite a lively fashion about your talks with the Israelis when they were chomping at the bit to launch a unilateral attack on Iran. Your discussions with Ehud Barak, your friend, as you call him. It seems like you had a very good relationship. And you said, you guys shouldn't worry about we having your back because you can't really take out Iran's nuclear program on your own, but we can. So don't worry about it. If they get a usable nuclear weapon, we're going to take care of business. But Prime Minister Netanyahu has threatened again and again and been very militant, even speaking to our own Congress, that he's ready to take action. What's the state of play on that right now? And do you think the United States can still persuade the Israelis that there's no big win in them for unilaterally attacking Iran?
Well, it's hard to say how the last 4 years in the Trump administration probably provided Netanyahu with a pretty free hand in dealing with threats as he saw them from Iran. Whether or not Israel can be constrained is probably dependent on the kind of case that the United States can make that, you know, we obviously have Israel's interests at heart. We are bound to them in terms of their defense. But at the same time, in dealing with Iran, the fundamental issue is, can we stop Iran from developing a nuclear weapon? That's the fundamental issue that we're all concerned about. And the United States shares that concern with Israel. Now, from an intelligence point of view, there have always been differences as to how fast Iran could develop that kind of weapon. And as a result of having stepped away from the agreement, the nuclear arms agreement, and allowed Iran to further enrich fuel, they probably are a hell of a lot closer to developing a nuclear weapon today than they have been in the past. Having said that, I think the case has to be made to Israel. You know, can we find an effective and verifiable way to restrain them from moving forward and be able to enforce that? It's in your interest as well as our interest. Is it worth that effort? And I think that's the way to kind of approach Israel. Saying pretty clearly that we still have the same goal in mind. If they develop a nuclear weapon, that is unacceptable to the United States and it's unacceptable to Israel. But in trying to get them to back away from that threshold, I think that it's in Israel's interest to support the United States in this effort. Look, Israel, I understand their mentality. I understand that they feel that they've got to do everything necessary to protect their country. I understand that. But at the same time, I think the bottom line is that if war were to break out in that part of the world, Israel would need the United States to come to their defense. And rather than force that issue, doesn't it make a hell of a lot more sense to try to see if we can find a diplomatic solution first?
There seems to be a consensus now that Iranian civil authorities may not be in total control of the government. And with recent actions by the Iranian Navy, or the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy, it seems that there are elements in the Iranian government that don't want a nuclear agreement either, who seem to be chomping at the bit for a conflict with Israel and the United States, which seems to be a big losing proposition, but they're going to think what they're going to think. Have you been following it closely? And is that your observation as well, that we don't really know who's speaking for the Iranians right now?
Jeff, I think you've touched on what is perhaps the most volatile issue in dealing with Iran right now, is that nobody may be in charge. And if that's the case, and you continue to have these incidents that we've seen recently in which attack ships are going after our U.S. Navy vessels, in which harassment is taking place with regards to our vessels as well, and where there seems to be an indication that the IRGC is doing their own thing, or at least elements in the IRGC are doing their own thing. Any misstep in that area could very well lead to war. I mean, that's the bottom line. And yeah, right now, I worry that if there are elements that are doing their own thing and creating these issues of harassment, what is going to happen is a misstep of some kind that is going to result in retaliation. And that could very well have us at war.
Right. There's a lot of people who think the same about U.S.-China conflict in the South China Sea. As we know from history, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the war games in 1983 in Europe almost led to an exchange, a nuclear war. This can happen. This is not the stuff of Hollywood and movies. This has actually happened, that we came very close to nuclear war. And it seems like we're on tenterhooks as well in the Middle East, as but even more so in a way with China, where you've got ships in the night, if you will, cruising about, challenging each other's right to be on a spot on the water. That's got to be something that keeps you up at night as well.
Well, yeah, there. I mean, there are several important problems with China. Obviously, the South China Sea and the need to ensure that we have freedom of the seas and we maintain freedom of the seas in that area, despite their effort to militarize some of these islands in the South China Sea. That's certainly one area of friction. The other is Taiwan. The Chinese continue to be much more aggressive about threatening Taiwan. And to a large extent, the United States has made clear that, that would be a very dangerous step for China to take and could very well result in a war in Taiwan.
That's an away game for us. It seems to me that they could take Taiwan. I think that's generally the consensus. It would be like taking, us taking Bermuda, in a sense. But China would pay a big price internationally for doing so. But they have their own domestic issues as well, their own hawks who are saying time is running out, and we've got to grab Taiwan now. So that's a big problem.
Yeah, no, I think that that's the concern. Although, the history here of China has generally been one of always looking at the long term rather than the short
term. That's right. That's right.
And I think we always have to keep that in mind, that they have never tried to suddenly take a step that could very well involve war. I think that there will be those that will argue for that in China. I think that, nevertheless, I think the leadership in China understands that their first priority is to build a strong economic force in China that can use that capability in order to place itself in the number one position in the world in terms of not only dealing with economic issues, but military issues as well. That's what they're focused on, is that long-range goal. And I think to suddenly go to war in Taiwan or go to war in the South China Sea would clearly undermine that effort, because there's no question that the United States would have to make them pay a price.
My guest today is former CIA director and defense secretary Leon Panetta. And going back to home now, I think everyone agrees we really have to shore up our own politics to get some sort of national consensus going. In the last few days and weeks, I think I've sensed real serious alarm growing that the Trump extremist takeover of the Republican Party presents a national security threat. After all, their rallying cry now is the big lie about the elections, that the elections were stolen. We used to be able to kind of shrug this off. It's just crazy stuff. But now it's congealing into a real powerful potential threat to our democracy. Now, in Germany, you probably know that they've announced that they're going to put anti-vaccination activists, some who are backed by Russia, under surveillance as a threat to their national security. Do you think that the CIA and FBI should be taking similar measures against right-wing activists and elected officials now who are undermining our democracy with lies about vaccinations and elections? They are putting into place the pieces of a blockade, you might say, to invalidate not only President Biden's election, but future elections of a Democratic president. That if this Trump-controlled Republican Party gains control of the House and the Senate, that they could invalidate the election of the next Democratic president. That's a national security issue. What should we be doing about it?
Well, you've identified what I think without question is a national security issue for the United States. When we talk about national security, we always focus on military power. We always focus on diplomatic power. But the reality is that the stability of the United States, the political and economic and social stability of the United States, is critical to our national security. And what we've seen happen, particularly on January 6th, where an insurrection took place of the United States Capitol, and one that brought our democracy to a stop, the threat of that kind of domestic terrorism really does represent a threat to our security, a threat to our stability. And then if you combine that kind of domestic terrorist threat with this approach to basically telling untruths about what's happened in this country, what happened in the election, the big lie about who really got elected in November, and try to use those kinds of misstatements and untruths in order to create a political movement in this country. I think we have to be wary of what can happen to our democracy. Our democracy is fragile. I don't think we can take it for granted. And therefore, I think it is really important for the FBI, for law enforcement, to focus on those kinds of domestic terrorists whose principal goal is to undermine stability in this country.
Mm-hmm. Now, separating the terrorists from the enablers is very difficult. I mean, we have battled for hundreds of years now over intrusion into the private lives of citizens, going back to the Alien and Sedition Acts under President Adams, the Watergate abuses and so on, and even some actions that President Obama took on national security grounds to investigate journalists, leaks, prosecutions, and so on. So what do you do about officials who are elected, who are committed to destroying our democratic form of government?
You know, I'm often asked the question, do you have to choose between security and our freedoms? And I don't think you have to. I really don't in our country. I think we can protect our security and at the same time protect our freedoms as well. But to do that, I think we really have to make sure that we elect leadership in this country that is committed to protecting our freedoms and our democracy and our security. I think the ultimate answer here still has to rest with the people in this country. That's the ultimate check in our democracy. And I think that there are, and I believe this with all my heart, I think the vast majority of the American people understand what's right for our country, understand the craziness that's going on today with a small element in this country, and understand that in the end, we all have a responsibility to protect our own country, to elect the right kind of leadership in our democracy, and to prosecute those who would try to undermine our stability and violate our laws. I still think that's the best approach to being able to defend our democracy.
Well, maybe that worked in the past. You and I are almost the same age. We didn't have anything like Fox News to contend with growing up. But here you have, and I don't want to dwell on this forever, and I know your time is limited, but here you have a broadcasting outfit with an immense audience that is absolutely convinced that the elections were stolen and other conspiracy thinkings. They turn that into votes for candidates. And the Republican Party's actions this week to expel members who challenged that big lie speaks for itself. So we really do have a different kind of challenge. In our system, there's no way we can shut down Fox News, right? But it's poison.
Well, look, you know, you mentioned our age. I think the fact is we have seen threats to our democracy in the past, going back to the 30s, going back to people who used to go to the radio and demand that we become a socialist country, going back to people who wanted to make sure that we isolated ourselves from the rest of the world, going back to Joe McCarthy and all the concerns he had about the threat of communists. We have had those in the political arena, in the media, who have all tried to preach untruth. And ultimately, the truth wins out. And although I share the concern about seeing the kind of lies that are being talked about today, I really think that in the end, the truth will prevail. And that, you know, this country has survived a hell of a lot in our over 200 years of existence. And the reason we've survived is because ultimately our leadership and the American people ultimately do what's right. And I think they'll do that today.
Well, I sure hope you're right. I have moments when I share your optimism and other moments when I'm pretty gloomy. Well, you're talking to us from California. And so I have to actually turn to your wonderful memoir, Worthy Fights, and read from it. The penultimate page, 466. Okay, it's a doorstopper, let's face it. You write, after decades of commuting across the country, I'm home with Sylvia, your wife, in the house my father built. The walnut grove he planted still bears fruit, and I still care for it. My sons are grown, and I have families of their own. My father never went to college. Two of my sons are lawyers, and the other is a doctor. America's gifts to me were not ideological or partisan. They were of opportunity and family and security. As Americans, we may disagree on everything from baseball to national defense, but we're united by our most basic needs and by the dreams we have in common. Which sounds like you're pretty happy being ensconced out there in the walnut grove. But let me ask you on the way out.
As I said, when I left Washington, I was going home to work with a different set of nuts.
But let's raise it. Hey, do you miss the action? Come on. You got to miss it a little bit.
Oh, you know, I always do. Having spent over 50 years in public life, you of course you miss the action. But I also, you know, have a son who was elected to my old seat in the Congress, and I'm basically able to enjoy my thrills through him.
That's good to hear. Secretary Leon Panetta, former CIA Director Leon Panetta, it's always fun to talk with you, and thanks so much for your generous sharing of time today on the Spy Talk podcast.
Jeff, it was a pleasure to deal with you, and I appreciate your podcast because I think you're focusing on kind of the key issues that we've got to talk about.
Well, we hope so. Thanks a lot.
Jeff, that was fascinating. He was amazingly reflective and also amazingly chatty for a former CIA director.
Yeah, you know, I've interviewed several CIA directors, and he's so engaging and actually warm, not clinical, very reflective, as you said, and he's just a pleasure to interview. And there's not a lot of deception going on there either that I can detect. So it's really enjoyable for me to be able to talk to a CIA director who is both voluble and insightful.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. And thanks to all of you for listening. Join us again next week for another edition of the Spy Talk podcast. I'm Jean Meserve.
And I'm Jeff Stein. Pleasure talking with you. See you next time.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyal from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.